Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
From Cabernet to Malbec, they're here to slay the art history, babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Natalie.
I'm Jen.
I'm Ginny, and we are the Art History Babes.
Today we have a special guest with us.
Oh my God!
Miss Christina. Christina, say a thing or two about yourself.
Hey.
You're so bashful and cute.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here with all of you guys. I was part of everybody's program. I just recently graduated. I'm a bit of a little art history interloper. I like to go between periods. So I love antiquity and I love also Italian Baroque. Mm. I'm especially interested in sort of representations of ancient mythology. So that's essentially what my thesis was on.
Yeah.
And that's how I sort of got to know the lovely ladies of the Art History Babes.
And Christina, so. Christina's my mom. When I got into the program, I didn't know what I was doing. And
me
she took
neither.
Care of me. And so I call her mom when I'm feeling very affectionate.
Aww. Yeah, it was actually...
Hi, Mom.
It was Christina and Maisie who showed me the ropes. And it was good. It was good to have them around.
They know what they're talking about.
Yeah,
they're legit.
We were lost. And, you know, I just hope that we can be there for the new people.
I'm not sure, though, because I actually have questions for Christina when we're done recording. And she's already graduated, and I have questions.
But thankfully, she's still around, and we're very, very
happy. Reliant on her.
Well, the thing about your guys' class, too, is you guys are just a lot better at pretending you know what's going on,
right,
even when you don't.
Right. We're big fans.
We are not. We are so transparent.
Yeah.
We are just like, I don't know what's happening.
We never pretended to know what was happening. A typical day would be to walk into our collective office
and have the second years find you first years.
Right. And then
freaking out.
And like slam the door and be like, what the hell's going on? What is happening?
Yeah, we were entirely transparent. So Christina's with us today. She's gonna help us talk about architecture and power a little bit.
Yeah,
she knows a lot.
She knows those things. Before we dive into it, I have a quick correction to make from our last episode. It's not a big deal. It's just something I noticed. We quickly, in our second installment of Cubism, Cube Your Enthusiasm, part two... we briefly talked about Piet Mondrian, and both of us referred to him as French, and he's not French.
Oh, yeah.
He's Dutch. He's Dutch, and after he moved to Paris, he dropped one of the A's from his name.
I was going to say, that's such a French name.
Yeah, he dropped an A from his last name. Mondrian used to have two A's, and he dropped it. So he could, better integrate himself into, the Parisian scene.
Well, congratulations, Pete.
Pete?
I've been calling him Piet.
Yeah, and you can pronounce it that way, I'm pretty sure. Piet Mondrian.
Congratulations, Mr. Mondrian, because
it worked.
Yeah, so correction there. So we're going to dive in, because we have a lot to say about architecture and what it means for
a whole lot.
Yeah, it means a lot
for humans in general.
What does it mean?
So I'm gonna hand it over to Natalie, and she's gonna get us started
with the assistance of Christina.
Hello, everybody.
Thanks for being here.
I've just been practicing my NPR voice.
Let
me know how it goes.
There's a whole new level of sensuality that's being brought to the podcast today.
Christina, thank you for being here, and let's talk about architecture.
Thank you for having me, Natalie. That may have been too soft.
Yeah. If you get real, real close and just start to seduce the microphone, think we're going to have a different kind of
just
podcast.
Just lick it a little bit. Okay, so architecture and power. So going all the way back to antiquity, which we're talking BCE here, we're going all the way back to the Egyptians, to ancient Greece and Rome, just that's a general overlay of what we're going to cover. As strange as it may be to conceive, there was a time when architecture was non-existent, and so there were nomadic tribal people who moved around a lot and didn't have a steady home. So at a certain point, when people did start to stay in one location and build, even if not entirely permanent, more permanent homes, so using things like mud bricks and wood and things that are technically impermanent but more permanent. So you start getting this division between what the stable dwellers would consider as civilization and then the uncivilized or barbaric, as they would consider people who were still nomadic. So this really, like, comes into effect with, like, you're dealing with the ancient Greeks and, give me an example, Christina.
Well, also, it's
Gauls?
Gauls. I mean, it's interesting that you bring up the idea of temporal versus sort of permanent materials, mm-hmm. because we often look at existing architecture from the past as, you know, like the pyramids and the Greek temples that you're going to be talking about in a little bit as these big monuments to power, but the reason we talk about them is because we still have them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a lot of, you know, big important structures for other cultures that would have been really important were built out of more temporary materials, sort of like wood,
yep.
Things that were not meant to be, you know, long lasting. And so we don't talk about them. So
yeah.
It's interesting that we only, you know, we focus on things that have construction that has a more permanent quality.
It's like at a certain point, humans started to realize that permanence equated power. That if
and
you
to legacy.
Yeah, exactly. Legacy that started to make sense because you realize that if something was older, it gained value just by the passage of time. So architecture definitely played into that and was powered by that. So you get the idea of civilization versus barbarism, and then that leads into parallels with the Greeks. So you start seeing temples, which are for Greek gods. So you see a lot of columns, and you get these long aisles that you end up walking down. Also, you have to realize Greek temples are very open. So you aren't dealing with real walls. The walls are made up of the columns. And you have Ionic and Doric columns originally. And then later on, you see
Corinthian columns.
Which we'll put a little nice diagram on the website. Essentially, they just get more complicated. And you also, if you go to Africa and you go to Egypt, you have the pyramids. And the pyramids really are not defined, but their importance comes from their size, essentially. Like, that's what really amazed people back in that time. Like, the size of the pyramids was so overwhelming. And if you really think about the time period and how large and how permanent they are, you can understand why people still are amazed by them today. Like, it's a big deal.
Yeah. The pyramids were based on an earlier form. They're called mastabas. So they've had these sort of pyramid-like structures before, but they were never quite at the height that we see at the pyramids of Giza.
Think like a plateau, like a pyramid and a plateau meet.
Sort of like a bunch of smaller squares sort of stacked upon
yeah.
each other. So they were much more smaller in scale, but they were still very prevalent
mm-hmm.
in the old kingdom of Egypt. But then with the Great Pyramids of Giza, then you get these much larger structures and you have them in a sort of a large complex as well. So that whole, the fact that they're in a larger complex denotes that this area is a place of power, a place of religious importance, a place for the pharaoh to express his power even in the afterlife.
And they had rock-cut tombs for a period of time in Egypt, which were built into the land. So instead of building up, you would build into the ground. But those ended up being a little less successful and memorable, and mainly because we're kind of simple creatures, and we like big things.
Yeah.
And so the actual pyramids, with their height and just their physical presence, like, were much more successful than the rock-cut tombs. And we have Hatshepsut.
Yeah, Hatshepsut's a big name in Egyptian rock cut tombs. Her mortuary temple
mm-hmm.
is a big one.
But she was a female. She was the only female.
I'm not sure if she was the only one, but she was the most. She's the most well known
female pharaoh. So not to be mistaken as like,
a queen.
Yeah, but there's no differentiation. Yeah.
She presented herself as a male pharaoh.
Oh yeah, didn't she wear the
Yeah.
She wore
the everything that would be sort of characteristic of a male pharaoh, the beard and the headdress and everything.
And as she started out as more feminine in appearance in sculptures and depictions of her, and then she started to become more masculine over time. So you would actually it seems trivial, but her breasts would start to become flatter in sculpture. The other interesting thing is she was supposed to be wiped off the map in a way. We aren't supposed to know about her because her
successor,
thank you,
wanted to wipe her out
mm-hmm.
to assert his own authority. So he tried to get all of the images of her at her temple sort of crossed off, mm-hmm. defaced, so that she wouldn't exist anymore. But we still know about her.
Fucking patriarchy, man.
Anarchy. It.
So if they were more successful with other female pharaohs, we will never know.
Hey, we'll never know.
So yeah, but okay, so that's Egypt. And you know, everyone's pretty familiar with the Egyptian pyramids, but that's...
And I know we already have a very long list of future episodes, but we'll do one on ancient Egypt, too.
Oh, 100%.
Well, of course.
There's so much to say.
Talk about obelisks.
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 Obelisks. Yes. I put an extra S in there.
That's fine.
Obelisks.
No.
So, yeah, architecture starts becoming, and especially permanent architecture, or what we can call quote-unquote permanent, so what you can feasibly see as lasting, becomes a sign of power.
And especially because these are being made by people in power.
Yes.
It's not so much of using permanent materials for, you know, your, like, your
because
weekend
those
getaway
can be
house.
Taken down. We will see that, too.
Yeah.
That can be done.
But
you
the
can
fact
erase
that, yeah.
history.
But the fact that these are being made by people in very high political positions gives them a sort of a different sense of authority
mm-hmm.
than other, you know, maybe more permanent structures.
Yeah. And also the fact that the Egyptian pharaohs were very in tune to the fact that if they wanted a pyramid or some sort of burial tomb that would be really large and extravagant, they had to build it in their lifetime, because if they died before it was finished, it probably wouldn't get finished because no one cared to
They keep were starting
going.
their own monuments. So.
As soon as you came into power, you got to start planning your own burial tomb. They
Plan
knew
it before.
They knew
Plan
how to
it
last.
Before.
That we already kind of talked about the Greeks, but really in the archaic period is when you start seeing these temples built. So between 600 and 480 BCE, just side note, this is purely to do with Greco-Roman origins, Western art. There are things going on in other parts of the mm-hmm. world. So just to be specific, that this isn't the origins of architecture in all. This is just a specific location. But they're building temples. We see a lot of columns again. And stone temples. Before there were wood and mud brick. Those are not lasting, so they realized they needed more permanent options. You see this again and again, these kind of tropes, because it's the birth of democracy, so people really equate back to that all the time.
Yeah,
and that's why we still see these same kind of architectural features.
Yeah, and when the Romans got into power, they looked to the Greeks as sort of an artistic model and their own sort of native Italic traditions, but they really liked the Greek way of building and the Greek aesthetic, and they sort of adopted that into the Roman aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the expansion of the Roman Empire, these Greek ideals sort of get carried across all of the Roman Empire, which is essentially most of Europe and a lot of North Africa and even into sort of the Middle East. And that's why you see sort of the prevalence of these forms, and you see them today. You know, you look at the state capitol, you still see, you know, the columns, the pediments.
Yeah, so there's a reason that the White House looks very obviously Greek slash Roman. Mm-hmm. It's
carrying these ideals.
Neoclassicism.
Yeah. This neoclassicism ideas that were instilled by Greek and Roman architecture that was carried throughout the empire and then later sort of revived because they were associated with such a strong political power and such strong political ideals.
So we believe in democracy, so you will see
democracy
these democratic buildings because democracy.
because democracy.
And that's all she wrote.
And this is true.
So the White House, it's big and white and kind of ancient, ancient looking.
People live there.
People live there. Important people. And yeah, and as I said, it looks like it does for a reason, because those are over time are characteristics that have come to represent power in various buildings. Okay, so I'm gonna jump ahead a little bit. This episode kind of jumps around in time. We skip all over the place
we're
a little
being
bit.
Time travelers.
Today. Yeah.
Doctor Who fans out there.
Oh God.
Get out of here.
Oh God. So yeah, we're taking you on a time traveling expedition. I'm going to be talking mostly about a modern architect, Le Corbusier.
Oh.
you're gonna hear some interesting information, but you're gonna hear a lot of disdain too. Before I really get into him and his story, I want to kind of touch a little bit more on what Natalie and Christina were just saying with this notion of antiquity representing power and setting up this idea of what is powerful and what is good and what should be emulated. And as I kind of mentioned before, like going back to the White House example, like the White House is white because a lot of these ancient remains that we have from like ancient Greece and ancient Rome are white. We discovered them and they were white, and we decided as human beings that meant something.
This is where it all began.
And the color white connects to Le Corbusier in a very real way. But the important thing to note here is this idea that the great buildings and sculptures of ancient Greece and ancient Rome were white is entirely misguided. Mm-hmm. Because if you didn't know this already, research has shown us that these buildings and sculptures were actually painted. They were
colorful.
They were very colorful, quite cheery actually. We'll put in. There's some recreations of what these famous sculptures or buildings most likely looked like, with like the pigments and the different colors they had at the time. So we'll put an image of that on the website for you to look at. So really, this whole history of white representing what it does, it's misguided. And there's a particular dude we have to thank for that.
Oh, yes.
Good old.
that's not his name. Johann Joachim Winckelmann. So Winckelmann is, you know, if you take art history, he'll probably come up. He is an 18th century German archaeologist and art historian. And really, like, the discipline of art history got its foothold during the 18th century in Germany. So a lot of the way that things are taught and thought about with art history and architectural history are really based in a lot of these 18th century German art historians. And so Winckelmann loved antiquity. He thought it was great. He loved the sculpture. He loved the architecture. And he was really struck by this white marble that he saw in sculptures, that he saw in architecture, and he eventually went to Rome and was just really in awe of all of this marble that he saw. Italy has one of like the biggest marble quarries in the world, and it's Carrara marble, and it's very, very white. It'll have some veins that are kind of bluish, grayish, but for the most part, it is very, very white. And Winckelmann was just like, wow, this is beautiful. Everyone needs to know. Everyone needs to see like this beautiful, white, pure marble. And
that he would write about it, and he really got it out there, and people started catching on. And then you start seeing, like, these white classical buildings popping up everywhere from the 18th century onward, and that this, you know, as Natalie and Christina were talking about, like, with classical architecture, there's a perceived timelessness and kind of endurance of passage of time, and that in and of itself represents something that is both beautiful and powerful. And so Winckelmann can really be credited with kind of getting this out into the world from the 18th century onward of what is perceived as, like, beautiful and powerful in this white marble architecture. So Winckelmann, wow. Fun fact too, he loved tight leather trousers.
Jeannie, can I just say that when you start going on about something and you're, like, really in the zone, it's, like, my favorite thing. I just needed to say that. I hope that our listeners enjoy it as much as I do.
Thank you. You make me blush.
Aww. She is. She's blushing.
She right is.
Now. Oh. It's also really hot.
Okay, so that's kind of a peek into where these ideas about the color white came from, especially in terms of architecture. Yeah, as I said, another person that the color white was very important to was Le Corbusier. And
what's his actual name? Do we know?
Yes, we do know. Le Corbusier was born Charles-Édouard Ginaret.
Ooh, beautiful. Great pronunciation.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, that French kicked in handy.
Yeah.
That's not a phrase, kicked in handy. Aim in handy.
Kicked in handy.
Sorry, I just combined two phrases.
No, it's perfect. Kicked in handy.
Let's start a movement. Hashtag kicked in handy.
Yeah.
She's catching on so fast.
Yep. Hashtag that shit. Okay. So he was born in rural Switzerland. 1917 was when he adopted the name Le Corbusier, which was actually a variation on his grandfather's name. Mm. Took his grandfather's name and kind of, like, changed it a little bit, and he became Le Corbusier. It doesn't really mean anything besides that.
Yeah, but you know, it reminds me, have you guys ever met, like, a person who makes up their own nickname and insists that you call them that?
Yes.
But literally nobody wants to call them that.
They're like, fine, we'll call you Le Corbusier.
Yeah. Exactly.
I think that's pretty valid in this instance. He just decided that was his name. Okay, and he's very well known as an architect. In addition to architecture, he was also a painter. His paintings emphasized clear forms and structures, and these same characteristics were very obvious in his architecture. So the main characteristics of the things he built, he was all about steel. Mm. All about reinforced concrete. Totally about that reinforced concrete. All about geometric forms. So very modern. Like, he is the forefront of modern architecture. Like, no doubt about it.
Sorry, that's Natalie's high tech wine opener. Yeah,
they've heard it before, right?
They've heard it before. It's quite the contraption.
$20 at Brookstone.
What is it? Bridgestone?
Brookstone.
We are in the age of wine.
Chocolate-covered pomegranates.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
They do.
Covered acai.
You can get those at bulk in Costco.
Acai?
Acai? Yes. Or acai?
It's acai.
Well, you have the insiders.
This is a teaching moment.
I got that Brazilian connection.
Woo! Ooh, child.
Anyways. okay, so his architecture, steel, reinforced concrete, geometric forms, a term that he would later coin as purism. Purity was very important to him, which you can imagine as his family were Calvinists. Yeah. So you have this kind of religious...
The word purity makes me nervous.
I know. Yeah, it's a weird...
Rightfully so.
Yeah, it comes from... In this case, anyways, it comes from this, like, religious ideal of certain things being pure. Mm-hmm. And then also, he was big on the use of the color white in his architecture. And he used a very specific white. The brand was Ripolin. Mm-hmm. And it was apparently the smoothest and cleanest of the whites.
Purest?
Yeah, the purest white.
Do we know if this white is still available?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a real thing.
Wow.
Yeah. So, Ripple in White, and he referred to it as moral white.
Oh, of course
no.
He did.
Oh, no.
Of course he did.
Triggered.
So obviously your surroundings, your choice of color in your living space reflects your morality according.
And it's white.
Yeah, exactly. And it's white according to Le Corbusier. So he developed these 5 points of architecture, which are pretty important. Maybe not important, but very influential. They did a lot for architecture, and some of them are very interesting. Like my favorite one, I think, and we'll list these like on the website, or we'll list a source with these on the website. But my favorite one is he incorporated roof gardens on flat roofs for both domestic purposes, so you could like go hang out on your roof and like be in the garden.
Okay.
And also to.
It's like the precursor to all like those like New York rooftops.
Yeah,
so, let's go hang out on the roof.
Who doesn't love a good rooftop?
Yeah,
bar. Yeah, a rooftop party. Okay. All about it.
Shout out to Monarch in New York City. Rooftop bar, really fun.
Yeah, everybody loves a good rooftop party.
Who doesn't like a good roof?
Yeah. Like, let's be real. He kind of started this whole roof gardens on a flat roof, and it had these domestic purposes, but it also provided protection to his concrete roofs. So that's kind of a cool thing he did. He also started the whole horizontal windows, like big horizontal windows.
That, hey, that's cool.
That's a nice thing. A big horizontal window providing even lighting for a room.
Realtors are thanking him right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So
big money.
As you can probably already hear, like, the disdain in our voice for this man.
We're like, oh, surprise, he did something actually that's nice.
Yeah, he did some cool creative things. Like, you can't 100% discredit him. But we're gonna get a little bit more into some of the shitty stuff he did. But anyway, so the things he did are the things he created in his architecture very much influenced the rise of brutalist architecture, which we've mentioned multiple times. We're not going to get into it too much on this episode because it doesn't quite fit, but some cool brutalist buildings out there, and those are very much characterized by that reinforced concrete look.
So
that was pioneered by Le Corbusier, also known as Corbu. We'll refer to him as Corbu from here on out.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
I would like to know, do we call it brutalism because it's made of these industrial materials and it does there's no effort to hide the use of like reinforced concrete? I've always wondered that.
Yeah, I think that has something to do with it. I haven't looked enough into the origins of the term, but that's what sticks out to me.
It's probably just super brutal.
It is actually super brutal. You should look it up.
I'm sure we'll do an episode on it at some point.
It's not only like they're just really cool buildings.
Yeah.
Back to
Corbu.
So Corbu's ideas really influenced that whole movement. So let's get into some of his really just like shitty, horrible quotes.
Yes.
Way more fun.
Okay, so I guess this one's not terrible, but he has this collection of essays published in 1923 called Toward an Architecture, in which this is kind of just the basics of his ideas. He was very into like modernism. The modern age is all about like machines in a lot of ways, and he was all about technology and machines. So in Toward an Architecture, he argues that modern machines could create highly precise objects very much like the ideal forms of ancient Greeks. So we have this idea of connecting back to the ancients, right?
Interesting.
Right?
Bring it all back.
Yeah.
Chin-stroking interesting.
Yes. So in his work, in his architecture, he is, quote, searching for modern perfection through universal forms.
Columns.
Yes, columns, man. So he's looking this purity, this perfection, this cleanliness. He's trying to create perfect architecture.
Right.
perfect living spaces, right?
Right.
And yeah, this connects back to his obsession with purity and whiteness and rippling and these kind of ideas. Okay, so he had this preoccupation with cleanliness. He was also really into his physical health. He exercised every morning, like, obsessively. He believed 100% that there was an ideal way to live. This was his personal philosophy. There was an ideal way to live, and he wanted to create spaces where one could live this ideal life. Mm-hmm. So that was his entire motivation.
What a loser. I'm just kidding. I'm just saying that because I'm, like, the laziest person that I know. So.
No, you are not.
You are not. You're,
I kind of am.
You're very motivated. And...
No. It's okay. This isn't a seeking attention, seeking compliments sort of comment. You know, I feel like I just want to say that the ideas that Corbeau was extolling via his architecture and his writings and things really do encompass modernist
thoughts. Like, oh, 100%. Really do. Yeah, no, that's actually a very important thing to bring up, because modernist thought, as much as I really enjoy diving into it, is pretentious as fuck. Yeah. It's so, like...
I don't think I've ever rolled my eyes harder.
I know, and it's like I...
Shut up!
Yeah, like, part of me loves it, because I'm like, this is smart and interesting, but the intentions, at least at the time, was very much to be like, I'm smarter than you.
Yeah.
And to separate the classes, to separate, like, who understood and who didn't.
Oh, and surprise, surprise, most of the modernists were white European men.
Oh! Shocker!
Shut up!
What?
Yeah. So yeah, Corbeau is definitely in that group of people.
Patriarchy.
So his most well-known building easily is the Villa Savoie. It's Savoie.
You're French.
I don't speak French.
You're a resident French teacher.
The Villa Savoie, and it's a UNESCO heritage site, so it's kind of this important building. It's pretty cool. There's, and we'll post a link to this. There's actually on YouTube a little virtual tour you can take of it.
Dope.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a fun little thing. Takes 5 minutes. It's a cool building. Like, yeah. As someone who appreciates modernist aesthetics, it's a cool building.
Nice.
It's in Poissy, France, outside of Paris, and it was designed in 1929 for a very wealthy family. The entire idea behind this building is he wanted to create this image of, like, a floating box. And yeah.
Oh, like the white cube?
Kinda, yeah.
Oh man.
No, he's very much in the realm of the white cube.
If you guys remember our last episode, I was really into that one.
And another shout out to Inside the White Cube by Brian O'Doherty. Read it.
Oh, Doherty.
So he's trying to create this floating box aesthetic. So to make this floating box, the ground floor walls are recessed and then painted green to kind of further this illusion of, like, so the green walls are supposed to help it blend into its surroundings and further create this idea of this, like, large floating box. And the interior has this really, like, dynamic energy. There's, like, this crazy ramp, and there's all these spirals. And it very much resembles the inner workings of a machine, which goes back to what we were talking about, his concerns with the machine age and what the machine could do for humans and for their quality of life. In fact, there's a quote by him that kind of exemplifies this. It's actually one of his most famous quotes. A house is a machine for living.
Mm. He would.
Yeah. So this house definitely exemplifies that. It's beautiful, but you can almost see the components, like the inner components of a machine when you're, like, walking through it. So, like we said, this house is designed for a very, very specific kind of living that he felt was the perfect way to live. So he felt very strongly about these things. Which brings me to, I think, the most important aspect of Corbeau's work in terms of this topic of architecture and power, is he got really, about 1930, he gets really into theories of urbanism and city planning. And he has a few different plans for a few different cities. And, oh, man. Okay.
If you want to, oh, man.
If you get ready to sigh at some of these quotes. Okay. So I have a few quotes by him. Just his thoughts on some different cities. So this is him describing Stockholm. His feelings
goodness.
On Stockholm.
Oh, goodness.
Are we ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. No.
Hold on to your...
Here we go. Frightening chaos.
Oh, no.
And saddening monotony. And not he good. Wanted to, and I quote, clean and purge the city with Oof. A calm and powerful architecture.
Sorry, Stockholm.
Yeah. So just, I mean, just
clean
the...
Clean and purge.
Yeah, the word purge, yeah. It reminds me of that movie that I haven't seen.
The Purge.
But the Purge.
Oh, there's like several of them.
Yeah, here. I haven't seen any of them, but this idea of purging an entire city.
That there's something wrong, intrinsically wrong about this something.
Yeah, exactly. Like, this is wrong and needs to be purged. It's gross. But, okay, but this one's even worse. Are you guys ready for this?
I can't wait. Maybe.
The design of cities is too important to be left to the citizens.
Oh! Fuck you, dude.
So Corbusier should probably design the city.
Yes. That's some
self-advertising.
Corbusier, maybe.
Hashtag Corbusier.
Hashtag Corbusier.
Okay, so. City planning. So the example we're going to go with, because I think it's probably the most important, is he, in 1931, Corbusier begins plans for the city of, for the French Algiers. Yeah, the French colony of Algiers.
Already, already on a bad list.
Yeah.
Problematic.
Problematic.
To be very specific, that means France came into Algeria
and decided
it was theirs.
Yeah. French said, You're mine now, Algiers. And then Corbusier said, I will make it better. And
I'll make it more racist.
Make Algiers great again.
Oh my god, yes!
That is so on point!
Wow!
Yeah, so that's essentially what Corbusier's trying to do, is make Algiers great again. Okay, so 1931, he begins these plans completely unsolicited. Nobody asked him to do this.
It's so sad in hindsight. I know.
Nobody asked him to do this, but he started these plans and would continue to work on them for the next 10 years of his life. An entire decade he spent on his plans for Algiers. And his intentions, what he felt he needed to do, was he wanted to raise Algiers to the level of an international city. Kind of a world capital of Africa, if you will. He had this fantasy of essentially a diamond of powerful Mediterranean cities. So Barcelona, Marseille, Rome, and Algiers. And he felt...
A diamond.
A nice little diamond.
Like, diamonds are forever.
Diamonds are...
Shade company.
Stop it.
I was going to say he and Kanye were on the same wavelength.
Oh, yeah.
My God. Ah.
Diamonds are forever.
Maybe Kanye is...
Rebirth of
Corbusier. No, I was going to say, maybe Kanye... No. Kanye's the reincarnation of Corbusier.
That's terrifying. Oh, no.
He's been much more successful.
Ginny's face is perfect right now.
Holy shit.
Okay.
She's like, no.
So he draws up these plans. He works on it for forever. The three main elements he wants to create in Algiers: a new business district on the Cape of Algiers, obviously business, because business is power. A residential area in the heights accessible by a bridge spanning over the Kasbah, which is the fortified city center of Algiers. And then a, quote, road town, which this is the most interesting to me. An elevated highway arcing between suburbs that contains 14 levels of residence beneath.
Oh,
I know. What a weird thing. So he envisioned this modernist megastructure laid over the Kasbah, which basically shows, and there's actually a nice little sketch of what he had in mind that we'll post, which shows a total disregard for the local culture. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but it would have created hardcore segregation between workers yeah. and the rest of the European communities.
And it was already there. He was just going to, like, amplify
it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, oh, another roll your eyes quote. Here we go. Here is the new Algiers. Instead of the leprous sores which had sullied the Gulf and the slopes of the Sahel, here stands architecture. Architecture. Architecture is the masterly, correct, and magnificent play of shapes and light.
Architecture.
I hate him.
I know. Architecture.
He's just so much better than everyone.
He sounds like one of those, like, art history professors that you know that you hate.
Yeah.
You know, like those stereotypical kind, like, of guys,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it's the seminar that you just dread.
You dread going to week.
Yeah.
And it's on a Thursday from 3 to 6 p.m. And
you
yeah,
just don't want to go. You just don't want to go.
And then you're in there and you're just like, God, I hate you the whole time.
Yeah. That's what he sounds
that
like.
That is. One last point on Corbu, because we haven't, like, ragged on him enough. And see, also, on top of all this, like, bullshit about, like, this is the ideal way to live, and essentially, like, I mean, it's in a more vague way, but, like, white supremacy, basically, like, Western supremacy, at least, he also, on top of that, somehow managed to also romanticize and exoticize the other in Algiers.
Yes. Oh, like the good little Orientalist was.
Exactly. So, yeah. So, in addition to being like, this is the right way to frame your city, and you need to make your city like this, he also, at the same time, was able to, like, romanticize the, like, Algerian way of life, like, just enough to, like, still fit his, like, colonial goals.
I saved these from our reading on Corbu.
Oh, are these his? Yeah.
Oh my God.
So, because they're actually beautiful. They really are.
No,
but
aesthetically, you can't say he's not a talented
person.
But
it also reminds me of colonialism.
Yeah, because this is what happened. So he's in Algiers working on these grand plans that no one asked him to make. And he starts spending time with women in Algiers. And all of a sudden, Corbu starts painting these super, like, mythic nudes with these, like, elegant curves. And, like, just Orientalism is all it really is mystifying of the women of Algiers. And, like, he's still able to serve his, like, colonial modernist viewpoint and exoticize the other. It's, like, amazing, truly. But yeah, so I don't even know if I mentioned this. His plans for Algiers were titled Plan Obis is the name for it. So we'll have an image of Plan Obis for you.
Such disdain, Corey.
I know. But ultimately, Plan Obis was unanimously rejected in 1942.
Let's all clap.
Yeah, let's. Well done. Yeah! So I think we're probably, this is once again going to be a two-parter because we have a lot to say.
We can't help it.
But before we jump into listener mail, I'm going to leave you with a little bit of a cliffhanger. So Corbu, in 1934, meets up with our favorite fascist, Benito Mussolini.
Oh, shit.
And Jenny has plenty to say about Mussolini. So stay tuned for number two on Architecture and Power. But let's pull up our listener mail.
Yes. So we have some listener mail. This is on our Facebook from Curtis. Curtis writes, "Hi, ladies. I love listening to your podcasts. You ladies make art history down to earth and fun. I really enjoy the episode on color theory. I'd love to hear more on that topic and topics similar to it. I especially love the bit about Michelangelo leaving out the Virgin Mary because he didn't have the ultramarine blue, giving his patrons the artistic middle finger. Anyway, love your show. Wish they were more frequent. Your fan from Canada." Aww, Curtis from Canada.
I love Canada.
I've
really
never
do.
Been to Canada. I've never been to Canada, but I want to go. Curtis, you should.
I might move to Canada.
You know what? Toronto Airport has a lovely Richard Serra in their international.
I
want to
go.
Right, wing.
Oh, dope. No, I love Serra. I want to go to Quebec and practice my French.
Hey, Curtis. Thanks for the mail. And we really appreciate you tuning in. And it is so exciting that you are so interested in our color theory episode because we were just thinking about doing some more stuff on color, but also I think that maybe, you know, as the year goes on, I think we can maybe delve a little bit deeper into some theory in general as far as art goes and art history. I mean, you know, I mean, maybe, because it's hard, and we can't be serious for like 5 minutes, so.
Well, I think we do a good job theoretically.
The theory
kind of flows out when you have a few drinks in you, but
I'm projecting.
But color we got on lock.
Yeah, I think what we're going to do, we'll probably do it sporadically, but a lot of people seem to enjoy the color theory, and we got a lot of comments about how much they learned about blue. So what we
love
just
blue.
Yeah, so what we
so
just,
much
blue, just, my boy.
Blue.
The boy blue. Anyways,
so what we've just what we've decided to do is we're gonna do sporadically. We're gonna do a series on different colors,
yes.
Individual colors for each episode. And our next episode, as we said, architecture and power is gonna be a two-parter. But our next episode after that, we're gonna do on the color purple.
Purple rain.
Yes. Yes.
That was beautiful.
It really was.
Oh, you had a good harmony.
Yeah, I think we do. I'm really proud of us.
So that's, I think, is going to be something we're going to pepper in throughout the year, is every once in a while we'll do just an episode on, like, a color.
We'll just pepper it.
We'll pepper it in there. just pepper it real quick. So we're going to do purple, thank you so much for your listener mail.
Thanks, Curtis.
We love hearing from you guys. Thank you
for
your...
Send us more mail. Come on.
We get some really nice mail.
We do.
But I want more.
Keep sending.
Jin's getting greedy.
I am. No, yeah. It's true. I'm very demanding.
She wants mail, so send it to her.
Now!
Also, in addition to sending us mail, which we love and we totally get excited on, you can do us a solid and you can go on to our iTunes and you can leave us a review.
Oh, yes. Please do that.
Yeah.
Because you know what? We need more of that. Comment on the SoundCloud.
Comment on anything.
Comment on anything.
But, like, the iTunes reviews are pretty key. That's how we get a lot of exposure, is if we have a lot of traffic in our iTunes reviews. Mm-hmm. So do us a solid. Go in, write a review, you know, what you like about us, whatever. Yeah.
Write anything.
Yeah, yeah. For real, though, right?
Just
anything.
A bunch of emojis. Like,
please do. I love deciphering emoji messages. Yes. That's like my favorite. Wet Steven?
Shout out to Wet Steven.
What is that? What is that?
Wet Steven is our...
We know.
I don't want to play favorites, but our one of our favorite reviewers.
Yeah. Oh, he's a great reviewer. Right. And he used an emoji. He's a little cool face emoji.
Oh.
A little cool guy. Sunglasses emoji.
I love him.
So write us a review on iTunes if you have a second. We so appreciate it. You can send us any questions at arthistorybabes@gmail.com. We're on Twitter at Art History Babes. We are on Instagram, Art History Babes Podcast. We're on Tumblr as Art History Babes. We're on pretty much everything. So, Facebook, like us. Those are important too. So, thank you so much for all your support. You're wonderful. And stay tuned for Architecture and Power Part 2.
Yes.
Woo!
We love you.
From Cabernet to Mall.
Ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.